I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback, the podcast that brings you the glory, the excitement, the unabashed glow of NPR stories from exactly 25 years ago. I'm excited to return with our regular Playback this month, because while I was on vacation, it seems that some wild and crazy stories made their way into the NPR archives of August 1984. Straight off the bat, you've got an interview with singer Randy Newman, sticking up for that town he so knows and loves.
Often the attacks on L.A. by people not from there and in other parts of the country are tremendously simplistic, you know, that there's no culture there and that everyone there is stupid and that they're all in hot tubs all the time. Not everyone's in a hot tub all the time.
I was kind of wondering about that. Randy Newman fills us in about some of the other stuff Angelenos like to do. And we'll have an interview with comedian Jay Leno about how he got his start.
So how many years until you felt you'd made it?
Well, I don't.
Jay Leno, the early years.
Yeah, Jay Leno, Gary Coleman, the early years. Have you read that book?
No. Yeah.
Jay Leno, the really early years, when you factor in the 25 years ago thing. And Tony Randall talks about his start acting in radio dramas.
I played Reggie, the Englishman. The fellow who wrote it thought that the Englishman only said, I say, and righto. So I just said, I say, Jack, righto. And I made a living from that for about 4 years.
We'll also have an exclusive interview with NPR's Lynn Neary about a guy who went public 25 years ago with his fascination for her voice. He called himself Mo Moskowitz, and he
lived like in the basement of his parents' house in New Jersey.
Sounds strange? You bet. Stay tuned for the slightly embarrassing story from Miss Neary herself. Kids, we got anniversaries this month. Lots of them. And normally, it can be a bit irritating for some of you to do the math, adding 25 more years to the equation. But they're nice round numbers. And these anniversaries are fun. Starting off with the 15th anniversary of a concert known as Woodstock.
Jimi Hendrix playing his version of the Star Spangled Banner, probably the most recognizable song to come out of the Woodstock Music Festival. Woodstock was billed as an Aquarian explosion, 3 days of peace and music.
Okay, people, we got the times. On the front page, you have on the left a very big aerial photo of a huge mass of people, which are you. And it says, music was the magic for throngs at Woodstock Music and Art Fair. 300,000 at Folk Rock Fair camp out in the sea of mud.
Actually, the crowd later was estimated at closer to 500,000 people. There were shortages of food and water, medical and sanitary facilities. The festival was plagued by persistent rain. Despite these problems, no major incident of violence occurred, although 3 accidental deaths were reported. The Woodstock Music and Arts Fair was held on the 600-acre dairy farm of Max Yasker.
I'm a farmer. I don't know how to speak to 20 people at one time, let alone a crowd like this. This is the largest group of people ever assembled in one place. But I think you people have proven something to the world, that 500,000 kids can get together and have 3 days of fun and music, and have nothing but fun and music. And I got a bunch of fun.
And not only did NPR observe the anniversary of Woodstock, the producers took time in their busy broadcast schedule to celebrate the 25th anniversary of a consumer product they probably could have used at Woodstock. They called it
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and reefs in just a minute. Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it. Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean.
NPR Scott Simon found August 84 a good time to chat with John McKee, the creative director at the ad agency that created Mr. Clean. McKee argued that Mr. Clean, earring and all, was a product of his times.
There was Mr. Baseball, Stan Musial. There was Mr. Republican, Bob Taft. There was a mister for everything. And so when this product came down the pike, or the concept for the product, Mr. Clean just seemed a natural. As far as what the guy came to look like, he went through a variety of sketches. He was kind of a genie at one time, but eventually evolved to this quasi-sailor. Just kind of a friendly, tough guy who got angry at dirt. And that's who he is today.
Let me raise a rather delicate matter with you. Mr. Clean wears a single earring. Nowadays, 25 years after his inception on somebody's drawing board, to wear a single earring in a single ear is regarded in some circles as a declaration of sexual orientation.
Do you mean how has that affected how people perceive him? Like, nowadays, people look at it and think it's a little weird, whereas before it had a kind of a magic to it?
Yeah, exactly.
That hasn't been a problem. I think that he's been around so long, and he's so unique onto his own type. And he's really a guy, you know? He's like just a regular guy that it's never been an issue. And I mean in letters or feedback from consumers or... Really has never been a problem.
Can he clean a dirty mirror?
He'll make it bright and clearer.
Can he clean a diamond ring?
Mr. Clean cleans anything.
Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean.
But there was an American icon who did have an image problem, kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum from Mr. Clean. August 9th, 1984, marked the 10th anniversary of President Richard Nixon's resignation from office.
To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
I just feel as though I've wakened from a bad dream. The last 2 years have been probably the most traumatic experience I've ever experienced. And I am 64 years old. I've lived through two wars and a depression.
If some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong. They were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation.
The American system works in effect. One can, by democratic process, remove the most powerful man in the country from his office when he has transgressed the rules which apply to the office.
I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved.
I was appalled and have been appalled at the vindictiveness that on the part of the people of the country with respect to the president. I feel that he really, while he may have done some of the things, even all of the things that it is claimed he has done, he only hurt himself and his own people. And I feel that certainly he has suffered by far more than any criminal prosecution could bring on him.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home.
The people of this country, down at my level, should be much, much, much more active. I believe that the leaders have gotten very complacent because of the lack of activity of the electorate. And I think that no matter what happens here, unless our electorate becomes more active, another 20 years down the pike, we're going to have exactly the same thing again, if not worse.
By taking this action, I hope that I will have hastened the start of that process of healing which is so desperately needed in America.
That was tape of President Nixon announcing his resignation in 1974, with commentary from listeners who called in as a part of a special NPR broadcast. It had been officially 40 years in August 84 since Paris was liberated from Nazi occupation. Here's commentary from writer A.J. Liebling, who was a war correspondent living in Paris at the time.
For the first time in my life, and probably the last, I have lived for a week in a great city where everybody is happy. Moreover, since this city is Paris, everybody makes this euphoria manifest. The gratitude toward Americans is immense and sometimes embarrassing in its manifestations. People are always stopping one in the street, pumping one's hand, and saying, "Thank you." It is useless to protest. To the Parisians, and especially to the children, all Americans are now héros du cinéma. This is particularly disconcerting to sensitive war correspondents, if any, aware as they are, that these innocent thanks belong to those American combat troops who won the beachhead and then made the breakthrough. There are few such men in Paris. Children, however, still follow the American soldiers everywhere, singing the Marseillaise and hopefully eyeing pockets from which they think gum might emerge. And it is still hard for an American who speaks French to pay for a drink in a bar. To drive along the boulevards in a jeep is like walking into some as yet unmade René Clair film, with hundreds of bicyclists coming toward you in a stream that divides before the jeep just when you feel sure that a collision is imminent. Among the bicyclists, there are pretty girls, their hair dressed high on their heads in what seems to be the current mode here. There are handsome young matrons with children mounted behind them on their bikes, and there are husky young workmen, stubby little employés du bureau, in striped pants, and old professors in wing collars and chin whiskers, all of them smiling and all of them lifting their right hands from the handlebars to wave as they go past. The most frequently repeated phrase of the week is "Enfin on respire," at last one breathes.
Writer A.J. Liebling. And now a bit of a break from all those anniversaries. This next bit of news actually did happen in August 84. President Reagan was warming up in front of an open microphone, and unfortunately, he happened to have said this.
All right, my fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
NPR's Daniel Shore had this to say about the now famous gaffe.
No one in public life should know more about microphones, their uses, and their perils than Ronald Reagan. He was a sports announcer early in his career and a syndicated radio commentator later in his career. And in 1980, he settled an argument about a primary debate in New Hampshire by announcing that he had paid for the microphone. And so, what causes President Reagan impishly to make provocative remarks while testing his voice level for his weekly radio talk? In October 1982, he warmed up for a talk about Poland by calling its communist leaders a bunch of no-good, lousy bums. That got out with some embarrassment. Reagan was cautioned by his aides to stick to counting 1 to 10, and the White House press corps was told that henceforth the president's warm-up was to be treated as off the record. But special standards have evolved for presidents and for candidates that dictate a public interest in everything from a Reagan polyp to a Jesse Jackson slur. It is difficult under these circumstances to protect the president from the consequences of his own indiscretions, because one way or another they have significance, and one way or another they are likely to get out. Reagan recently, in his own terms, extended a conciliatory hand to the Soviets by saying they could have their Mickey Mouse system. So what does it mean when he says into a microphone carrying his voice to network personnel, "Well, my fellow Americans, I am pleased to tell you that I have signed legislation today that would outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes." It is a joke, but is such a joke from a president without meaning? It will be exploited by the Democrats, all too eager to revive the theme of a trigger-happy Reagan. But was that not to be anticipated? Soviet propaganda will have a field day, but should one be surprised? The president may want in the future to try counting before the microphone. Up, not down.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. Actor Tony Randall began his career working in front of an audience. Unseen, but very much heard, Randall talked to NPR's Scott Simon about what it was like to be an actor in the early days of radio.
If sounds never die,
then somewhere in the universe, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is still rallying Americans.
This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
3, 2, 1.
The Mutual Broadcasting System presents I Love a Mystery, transcribed.
I was a stage actor looking for work, and actors always had to have another way of paying the rent. Mm-hmm. And radio was very, very valuable from that point of view.
Jerry thinks they're out to kill her, yet she says her sister Hope and her brother are in even worse danger.
I'd like to get hold of that Randolph Martin and give him peace of my mind. His children are in danger, and he keeps us up here waiting. He doesn't tell us what it's all about, and why doesn't he let us get on to it? Did you ever stop to think... Listen.
I Love a Mystery existed in some form on radio between 1939 and 1952, giving the ardent, non-smoking promoter of the arts and star of TV's Odd Couple an opportunity to act before a live microphone.
The fact is, it wasn't really acting. A 15-minute show, and that's what most of the work was, the soaps, yeah. You know, uh-huh. And the kids' adventure shows, each one was a 15-minute show. Uh-huh. A 15-minute show rehearsed for an hour. That is, if the show went on at 2 o'clock, you came to work at 1 o'clock. You had a reading, uh-huh. And then a dress rehearsal, or maybe two, and you were on the air. So you just stood there and read into the microphone, and any chance at acting was pretty primitive and remote. Now, in the early days of radio, there was a premium on the actor who could double. Say they had a cast of six, mm-hmm. in a given show, they would only have two actors in the studio, and they do all the voices.
You're kidding me. You mean do two or three voices in the same show?
Yeah. And eventually the actors' union put a stop to that, making it a rule that no actor could double more than once. That is, no actor could play more than two parts,
yeah.
And no more than two actors could double in a show. This made more work for actors, and it made the shows cost more, but it certainly improved the quality, because when the less doubling, the better it was for the show.
Well, were you one of those actors who could do that?
Yes, I could double. There was a very famous actor. His name was Phil Kramer. He, uh-huh. I perhaps shouldn't give his name.
He had a voice like this, and he was very famous for this voice like that. And he talked like that all the time.
Uh-huh. And a director asked him if he could double. And he said,
"Why, of course I can double. I can talk way up here or way down here."
Well... Well, what was your other voice? Let me hear that.
I could do almost any voice. At that time, I've lost that capacity. In
I Love a Mystery on WOR, yes. You played what's been described to me as a prim and proper Britisher.
Jack, Doc, and Reggie were the three adventurers.
Yeah.
And they were all rough, tough fellows. Mm-hmm. But I played Reggie, who was the Englishman. Uh-huh. And... I just used Ray Noble's voice. I said, all I actually had to say was, "Hello, Doc. I say, Jack, righto." That's the way it was written. The fellow who wrote it thought that the Englishman only said, "I say," and "righto." So I just said, "I say, Jack, righto." And I made a living from that for about 4 years.
Because Mrs. Martin's begged us to stay and help her out.
I say, that haughty, stiff-necked female aristocrat begged you to stay here?
That's right. So you can see how desperate she must be.
But what's the matter?
How do you feel about the fact that these radio tapes, preserving the voice of a very young Tony Randall, a Tony Randall that's not nearly as familiar or as well-known or as easily identified to the American public as the one we know now, how do you feel about the fact that these tapes are now going to be available for everybody for the ages?
I don't take that sort of thing too seriously. The fact is that in many parts of the country, people have been putting these tapes on the air and not paying us. That's much more important to me. Now you know my real character. I'm going to sneeze. Excuse me. It's a very high pollen day here in New York.
Gesundheit.
Thank you.
How would Reggie have sneezed?
Should I sneeze like Reggie, you mean?
If you can, please.
Plato!
You're so good at that.
Actor Tony Randall talking with NPR's Scott Simon. When Bob Edwards introduced Jay Leno to an NPR audience in August 84, he described him as an up-and-coming jokester. Leno talked with NPR's film critic Tom Shales about his first break, which included appearances on The Late Night Show with David Letterman.
It's a pleasure to welcome Jay Leno.
Yeah, I like doing that show. That's a fun show.
You two seem to get along.
Well, you know what's great about that show? Everybody on the show is about my age. I'm 34, and everybody is probably within 5 or 6 years of that. So I can go on the show and make obscure references to 60s rock bands or people from our particular generation or whatever, and everybody on the show knows what I'm talking about.
I saw Star Trek 3. You seen that?
No, I saw 2.
You like that? Yeah. It's not bad. You have to be a fan. Are you a fan of those?
I don't know.
I mean, if you're watching the show and in the first 5 minutes you see a crew member you don't recognize, you know they're dead by the next commercial.
So how many years until you felt you'd made it? And what were those years like?
Well, I don't...
Jay Leno, the early years.
Yeah, Jay Leno, Gary Coleman, the early years. Have you read that book?
No. Was there one magical night when Woody Allen came to see you? Or
oh, no.
Ed
those
Sullivan?
Things.
No, he was dead.
Well, but see, it's real funny, because when I was working, I started out, as I said, in Boston, and there used to be a little tiny jazz club called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston. And I went there, and I told the guy I wanted to be a comedian, and he said, okay, and he made me stand in front of his desk and do my whole act. I did like 20 minutes. And he said, hey, all right, listen, I'll give you a job. Why don't you come in next week, and I'll give you $20 a night or $25 a night. And that was unbelievable. I mean, I still think that's the biggest break I ever had. You know, obviously your biggest break in show business is when you do The Tonight Show. There's no great mystery to that. You know, you work the comedy clubs in Los Angeles. I used to work out of the Improvisation. And Harvey Korman once brought Johnny Carson in to see me and Andy Kaufman. And they said to me afterwards, nope, terrible. You don't have any act. You got to tighten this up. You got to do this. You don't have the right kind of material. I had real long hair. And they said, you're just not TV material. So I said, oh. So I kind of had to sit down and go over everything and figure out exactly what I had to do to get on these shows.
Looks like we may have a woman vice president. Pretty exciting. I think that's
yeah.
Pretty... You know, I'm amazed at the way the media is handling this, you know? I mean, they keep harping on the woman issue like it makes a difference, you know? I mean, you know ABC is going to do some kind of movie of the week out of this thing.
Sure, she was vice president, but she was still a woman.
Like, I read a thing in USA Today. They did this. Have you ever read USA Today?
Sure,
like,
I see it.
This is like America's... It's like America's biggest school newspaper, this thing. You know, I always feel like they should have like a think and do page on the back of this thing. They did a survey, and they were asking people if they thought the time was right for a woman vice president. I mean, like, it makes any difference. I mean, what do they think is going to happen, huh? If she gets elected, they think Chernenko the gigolo is going to show up at the White House, huh? Big fedora, candy flowers.
You know, you are very beautiful, my dear. You know,
like she's going to go, really? I guess I can show you some of the missiles. I guess.
As it turned out, the first woman who ran for vice president, Geraldine Ferraro, was soundly defeated in the 1984 presidential election. And Jay Leno, of course, went on to pursue a long, distinguished career in late-night television. And now he's got a new show called The Jay Leno Show. Which brings us to our next bit of playback celebrity fun. NPR's Noah Adams talked to singer Randy Newman to find out, what did Newman really think about L.A.? Did he love it or what?
How far back in your cheek was your tongue stuck when you wrote that song?
Midway.
You have said before that it's really important for you in writing a song, I'm thinking of the Baltimore song, to get the place right.
Yes. I think I did in L.A. to an extent. I made, the guy in the song is maybe a little ignorant, you know, he's not representative of your average Angelino necessarily. I mean, but I mean, riding around with a big redhead in an open car doesn't sound bad to me either. I mean, I sort of believe in it. That song comes closest to my philosophy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much depth to my philosophy, but that's it.
There are cynical songs about Southern California on the album Trouble in Paradise, but that's not one of them, you're saying?
No, there's a My Life is Good, which is about rich people in Southern California, which is maybe a little on the cynical side.
Yeah! The other afternoon, my wife and I took a little ride into Beverly Hills. Went to the private school, our oldest child attends. Many famous people send their children there.
Often the attacks on L.A. by people not from there and in other parts of the country are tremendously simplistic, you know, that there's no culture there and that everyone there is stupid and that they're all in hot tubs all the time. Not everyone's in a hot tub all the time.
Is the kind of songwriting that you do, when it's a personal sort of statement, is it difficult for you, after having written the song, to then share it, actually?
No. I don't make any connection between my personal life and what I create. You know, I'm not a particularly confessional type of writer. I don't think I am anymore.
I've been around the world, had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name, but it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top.
You know, E.B. White said that that writing was not difficult. All you had to do was sit down at the typewriter and wait till little drops of blood appeared on your forehead.
Yeah, there's a lot. Writers do a lot of whining, and I've done an enormous amount of it. And people have told me, you know, ease up. You know, I mean, it's better than working, and you know, don't complain so much about it. And I try not to, but it's tough, you know, making something out of nothing.
Is the pleasure for you? I'm just guessing here. In writing a song, thinking about one particular situation, writing a song, then having it interpreted in a way, in several ways, ways in which you weren't even thinking.
No. I like to set out to do something and have people get what I meant. I never in school, you know, when they give you poems to analyze, and someone would give this interpretation, the teacher will say, well, that's right. Then someone would give another one, and the teacher will say, well, that's right. I never liked it much, you know. I like to set out to do something and have them get what I meant.
Oh, it's lonely at the top.
Singer Randy Newman. Having people get what you mean would certainly have been on Mo Moskowitz's mind. In August 84, Moskowitz showed up on Morning Edition with an homage to NPR's Lynn Neary. Neary was a newscaster at NPR in 1984, before she went on to other hosting and reporting assignments. I recently asked Lynn to explain the Mo Moskowitz phenomenon.
Mo Moskowitz was, his real name was Robert Caplow, and he was just a funny guy. He lived, as I recall, he lived like in the basement of his parents' house in New Jersey, and either he was friends with or somehow came to the attention of the then senior producer of Morning Edition, Jay Kernis. And so he would do commentaries, highly produced commentaries for Morning Edition. And in one of those commentaries, he came up with this little jingle, First These Headlines from Lynn Neary, First These Headlines from Lynn Neary. I honestly don't remember why or what the context of that was, but that was the first time that, you know, we knew he had a little bit of a fixation on me. But I actually didn't know at all quite how much he was fixated until I heard that farewell for the first time.
Here's the piece itself, as it aired in 1984.
Good morning, Scott. Mo, au revoir, Moskowitz here. How you doing this morning?
I'm fine, thank you, Mo.
I insisted on being part of this Lynn Neary farewell tribute. As you know, I am the author of that number one hit song, First These Headlines from Lynn Neary.
These headlines from Lynn Neary. First These Headlines from Lynn Neary.
First his headlines from Lynn Neary. First his headlines from Lynn Neary.
The satirical songs of...
Oh, yeah, that song recorded by Lynn and the Nairobi Trio. As you know, it made her the number one hitmaker of her generation. But Lynn, she eschewed the life of the pop culture superstar. She sort of handed that mantle to me. And she opted rather for the life of journalistic integrity. But I don't know if you know, but many years before that song, I had written another Lynn Neary song. Are you familiar with that one?
No. At least I don't remember it right now.
Well, listen very carefully. You may never hear it again. All right, this was written for the original production of South Pacific. You know the song, This Nearly Was Mine?
Sure.
Well, listen now. I'm going to play you now the original version of that song.
One love to be living for. Lynn Neary was mine.
I remember that one now.
Yeah. Anyway, I do have one authentic Lynn Neary story to tell.
Please.
This is my sentimental story, so we need some sentimental music for this.
I'll remember how incredibly naive she was. I couldn't quite...
This takes place in California. About a year ago, I was visiting my aunt, and I was out there pretty much alone, just feeling kind of lonely and a million miles away from everybody I knew and all my friends. And it's about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'm lying in bed, and I put on the radio, and I hear a voice say, "Good morning, I'm Lynn Neary." And it was like a letter from home. And so on behalf of everybody whose morning has been warmed by that kind of, that kind and intelligent voice, I say, thank you, Lynn.
I'll remember her in the evenings when I'm lonely.
Mo Moskowitz, also known as Rob Kaplow.
Lynn told me that when this piece aired, she got a call from a concerned relative.
I had an uncle who, at that time, said to me, you know, I heard this thing on the radio the other day, Lynn, and he said, and if I didn't know you, I would have thought you died. He thought it was it sounded like an obituary. You know, I was really just leaving to go to host Weekend All Things Considered. So I was leaving my job at Morning Edition and going to Weekend All Things Considered. But, you know, that's the kind of thing we used to do back in the day on National Public Radio.
What his point was just that he loved your voice.
I guess so. See, that's the power of radio. Come on, you know? There he was. And he heard my voice, and it made him feel good in some kind of way that I can't explain. And I really didn't even know him.
So did you feel a bit embarrassed when you heard this?
Yes, I did, and I feel embarrassed now. I do. It's kind of embarrassing to hear that. You know, after that aired, he came to some event at NPR, and I had never met him. And I remember people coming up to me and saying, Lynn, Mo Moskowitz is here. Mo Moskowitz is here. You have to go talk to him. You have to go talk to him and meet him. And I was so embarrassed. I think he was too. And I think we literally went up to each other and shook hands and said, hi, nice to meet you. And then that was it. You know, we were both embarrassed.
How would you characterize this piece? Could you imagine hearing it today?
Never. Not in a million years. That would never hit the air anymore. So, good thing we have podcasts.
Yep, that's what I always say. Good thing we have podcasts. We hope you've enjoyed this one. Robert Speer helped, and Mike Katziff. Hats off to my librarian friends. Check out this podcast, and as a matter of fact, at npr.org. Next month, we'll have another First File edition of Playback when we go behind the scenes of the first ever Rat Olympics with veteran NPR producer Art Silverman. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.